Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out the Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Join co-hosts Will and Brian as they break down the lore of a rich multiverse 50 years in the making in a lighthearted and beginner-friendly way. They cover everything from character creation options to tips for Dungeon Masters. There's something for everyone, no matter how long you've been playing TTRPGs. Find the Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of IGN Unfiltered, our monthly interview series where we sit down with the best, brightest, most interesting minds in the video game industry. I am joined by a man whose career is fascinating and continues to be fascinating. I appreciate you joining me. Fergus Urquhart, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Happy to be
here.
For
coming on up to San Francisco.
Yeah.
You role-playing games have been your career, but the thing I wanted to start with you, obviously, is I get it bad enough with McCaffrey, but
right.
You must have the best Starbucks coffee cup names.
I think the best ones are just actually it even happened this morning when we were getting on the flight. So I drink iced tea, so I ordered my iced tea, and then she asked my name, and I said Fergus, and she just sort of like kind of and sent the cook, and then of course I heard and an iced tea for no name. So she just punted
didn't
it.
Even
she didn't even try. She just punted it. But I get a lot of Curtis. I get a lot of just looks. Like, what are you even talking about? That's not a name. I think particularly for my last name, I think it was always funny in school, like in elementary school, high school, something like that.
Yeah.
Particularly when we had a sub, because the sub would basically go through Smith and
right.
Russell
Cole.
And yeah. and then right before me was a guy named last name was Euler, and then we were all in a lot of classes together, so they would get Euler, and then there would just be this pause, and everyone in the class would just look at me, and I would go here because that was they wouldn't even try, they just would give up.
So your career, as I mentioned earlier, it's been overwhelmingly dominated by role-playing games,
mm-hmm,
which
absolutely.
I think is absolutely fascinating. Were you a pen and paper D&D player as a kid?
Absolutely. I think I got into D&D. It was a friend of mine. I think it was in sixth grade. It was a guy named Jason Buchanan, and I was at one of his birthday parties, and what's this D&D thing? I'd kind of heard about it, but whatever.
Yeah.
So really starting in sixth grade, we had the basic set, but we really got into AD&D fairly quickly. And then in high school, I was weirdly at that time the high school I was at. They had a gaming club, and so of course, we have obviously
tabletop
and role playing, and obviously we dated heavily because we were in the gaming club. But yeah, so I just really got and we played everything. I mean, we played D&D, we played Paranoia, we played Powers and Perils, we played RuneQuest. Otherworld, like we had just all this stuff, right? And just we played an immense amount of things, Villains and Vigilantes, all these games that I think Twilight 2000 people that probably don't even remember anymore. But yeah, really into it. I loved it. I mean, it was into comics as well. But yeah, pen and paper was one of my things.
So as someone who would go on to become a creator of video games, when you did play those tabletop games, were you the dungeon master usually?
I was not. So I don't know. I'd like to say that I wasn't a lazy child, but I think I was much lazier child than I was as an adult. And I wasn't. I think interesting also. I mean, I was your prototypical nerd geek. I was very. I like to be not in the shadows. That sounds right, but I didn't like to be at the forefront. And I think I had to force myself. And in eighth grade, I took speech because I had a fear of talking in front of people, and I think that was a big part of it. So I really enjoyed being with my friends and going on adventures. But I liked doing it, and I think also I didn't like to be the center of attention. I think, and that's what a DM sometimes is.
So what led you to the video game industry then?
I think at the time there was just such a, there still is such a great crossover, but I think back then is like my video gaming group, which back then was pretty much not video games, was too little bit video games, was mostly computer games with, I had a Commodore 64, my friends had Apples, we were playing Bard's Tales and Wastelands and all that kind of stuff, and so we kind of did both. We did the pen and paper and we did those, and I think oddly, just through how it all happens. Like I had friends who eventually, I had a friend who I got a job at Domino's and then he, pizza, that was my high school college job. And then he went to work at Egghead Software and then they got into a D&D game. It's all this really winding thing, but he got into a D&D game with a person from Interplay. None of us kind of even really knew that Interplay, which was a publisher, they're still kind of around, but they were the publisher we all first worked for. And he said, he got a job there in customer service. And then the summer of 91, he said, hey, they need testers for the summer. And so there we go. I got it. I never knew I was going to be a bioengineer. I was not going to be making games. And so I did it and then just kept on doing it.
So because this core group of people that you worked with ended up sort of really sticking with you even up really mm-hmm. through now.
Yeah, yeah,
Chris
yeah.
Avalon, most of them anyway. Chris mm-hmm. Avalon, Josh Sawyer, Darren Monahan, Chris Parker.
Mm-hmm.
How does that group come to form?
Come together?
Yeah.
So it's interesting. It really is... it really was Interplay, you know, and at Interplay, when I first started, I was like employee 30, you know, and then when I got rehired full time, I was like employee 111, and Interplay was just growing at leaps and bounds. And then I'm trying to remember the exact year, it was 93 or 94, Interplay got the D&D license. I was a producer at the time, and this is kind of where I guess where it all comes together. So I was a producer, and another producer, a guy named Rusty Buchert, who's done a lot of stuff, and he worked at Sony on Flow and things like that. He had run QA, who actually hired me originally, was him. And then he went off to be a producer on some other stuff, so they needed to give him games, and the game that they gave me was Shattered Steel. And Shattered Steel was BioWare's first game. And so that's kind of how I got involved with BioWare. And while that was all going on, like Chris Parker and Darren were both in QA, and Chris was... got hired into the RPG division before I was running it, and because he had been a pen and paper designer, and then you know other people like Scott Everts and Chris Taylor and a bunch of other people that still work for us and worked on the original Fallouts and stuff like that, we're all kind of doing different stuff, but we all you get to 95, and then when I started running Black Isle in 1996, yeah. we just sort of all kind of eventually came together into this division, you know, and got to work on a bunch of great games.
And that's the thing. For anybody that may be watching this thinking, who is this guy? Why does his name sounds vaguely familiar?
It's not just because of his name.
No, this is why you've heard of him. So your team would go on to make Fallout 2, mm-hmm. Planescape Torment, Icewind Dale, Baldur's Gate Dark Alliance 2, Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic 2, Fallout New Vegas, mm-hmm. And as far as and then most recently, I mean, you've got your own projects, but yeah. South Park The Stick of Truth was
a
yes. Mm-hmm, big game. One of my favorite games of 2013,
mm-hmm. 2014.
Oh, man. Time's flying too fast. What are the odds that you ended up connecting with a group of people that talented, that stuck together and made all those games?
I don't know. I mean, people ask me that a lot. And I think, I don't know. A lot of it was luck. A lot of it was a bunch of people, you know, because... it was a lot of stuff that was just all feeding together, you know, and I think that a lot of us loved games. We loved pen and paper, and we loved, and we wanted to make games that we would play. We wanted to make games that we love. We wanted to, and the person who I can give a lot of credit to is Brian Fargo. So Brian Fargo was running Interplay. He started, the first game he did was Demon Forge, which was like an adventure. I don't know how much of an RPG it was, but an adventure. But then he moved Interplay into where they were making Bard's Tale and Dragon Wars and Wasteland and stuff like that. And he was just a believer in role-playing games. He loved them. And so I think because he was the guy running the company, he let us do those things. And, you know, one of my, you know, the things I often talk about is because, you know, the stuff that we, you know, the Fallouts we developed internally, and then we worked with BioWare on the Baldur's Gates,
right.
and then Neverwinter Nights until it moved to Atari. But, you know, I always try to give Brian an immense amount of credit because, you know, with the original Baldur's Gate, BioWare had been kind of showing me builds before it was Baldur's Gate and everything. And then they've said, okay, we're going to sign with either Westwood or Surtex. So we're just going to show it to you one last time. And I'm like, okay, it looks amazing now. Let's figure this out. And you know, the head of development at the time just said, didn't get it. And he's like, whatever. That's not something to do. Because at that point, it wasn't a D&D game. And I said, my only part of the sauce was I said, well, Ray and Greg, why don't we make it a D&D game? And he didn't get it. And then luckily I showed it to the VP of marketing and she was like, I totally get it. And she called Brian. And I had an okay relationship with Brian at the time. He was still Brian Fargo to me, you know. It's so odd because, you know, I have lunch with him all the time. But he was like,
sure.
He was kind of like a star for me still back then. And he, not that he's not a star still, but so he came. It was like 2 minutes. He just looked at it and he goes, just sign it, you know. And I think... it was our passion for that stuff, and then just that there was a person there that allowed us to have that passion, and continue to get to play and not have to say, oh, ship this originally, not say, ship this in 12 months or 14 months. He gave us the time and he gave us the budgets and he gave us the people. And freedom. Like, he really didn't push us too hard on a lot of things.
Is that, does that sort of bleed through to your management style now running a studio? Do you kind of think back to that sometimes and go, oh, that's, I just need to give my people the freedom to do their thing?
Yes, it's hard sometimes because, you know, there's this thing I think at any time you're managing anything, whether it's games or maybe any kind of products. Like, for me, I want people to create, I want them to have ownership. I want them to create. I want them to create the things that they're proud of. But I also, like, we've, a lot of us have also been doing this for a long time. And so we know that there's certain roads that if you go down, it hits, you're going to hit a brick wall. And so a lot of times we're trying to, like, convince people, like, and help them see that. But to be honest, sometimes we know the best thing to do is let them hit the brick wall because that's how they learn the best.
Interesting. So despite all that success, all of you at Black Isle were laid off just before, if I have it correct here, just before Christmas in 2003. Did you start to see the writing on the wall with that, or was it a total shock when Interplay started
For us, you know what, it really all started with Interplay lost the D&D license, and ultimately they lost it because there was a bunch of unpaid royalties, and there was some arguments with some developers and things like that. And unfortunately, at the time, we were making Baldur's Gate 3. We'd built a whole new engine, and we were making Baldur's Gate 3, and it looked amazing. You know, as I was, I mean, obviously it wouldn't compete because this was like 2001, right? So it's not going to be competitive today. But you know, I was looking at some shots from it just, you know, probably a couple years ago, and it looked pretty damn good, you know. And so that was really disheartening. And I think I almost left in 2002, but I stayed on because I felt that I was responsible, and I was responsible for people there, and I was kind of the, not arrogantly, but I was the guy, there wasn't anyone to really take over for me, you know. And so I stayed on, and then by the early 2003, Brian had now been gone for a while, and I couldn't get computers approved. I mean, it was just, we were working on, even though we were still bringing in all the revenue, like, Black Isle, just, we weren't getting anything. And so so it was actually early 2003, and I left. I just decided, okay, I'm done. And then, Chris Parker, Darren Monahan, Chris Avalon, they followed pretty quickly. Dan Spitzley, Aaron Myers, they followed soon after that. Both of them, Aaron Myers was the lead artist on Planescape Torment, and Dan Spitzley was lead programmer. And then through the 2003, and then by August, we had signed up Knights Republic 2. And then right when, as we were signing up Knights Republic 2, that is when then Interplay started shutting down Black Isle. And I would say probably by the end of 2003, you know, we probably had about 20, 25 people, of which 23 of them were from Black Isle.
Yeah, that's you know, that's a lot of loyalty. Does that make you feel good when you have everybody stick with you like that?
Yeah, I'd love to know why sometimes. I mean, of course, everyone looks at themselves and thinks, oh, I'm a great guy and I'm a great boss and all that kind of stuff. And I think that if there's anything I could point out why I think people do stick with us, is we're really honest with everybody. A lot of people say in business that they have an open door policy. We really do. I mean, I think you could ask anybody at Obsidian and ask, do you feel that you know more about what's going on at the studio than anywhere else you've worked? Do you feel that you can talk to Fergus whenever you need to, if you had to? And I think the answers there would almost be yes. And I think that's... I don't know where I got that management style. I can't even tell you. There was no class. There was no book or anything like that.
It's just who you are, I guess.
It's how I wanted to be treated. I think, particularly in the early 90s, I mean, it was kind of, you know, nerds and computer dorks and everything who very not socialized very well, maybe, who were running everything. And that's who we were. We were just... It wasn't as cool. Like, it wasn't cool at all, you know, to do what we were. And I think that didn't lead to a lot of people that knew how to communicate. And I think that I saw that, like, I didn't like to be communicated with the way that I was being communicated with. Right. And I think I learned a lot that way. I don't know. And so we just kind of built that management style, you know, and I think that's how Chris Parker feels and Darren and Chris Jones. And so we felt that way, and I think that we've just continued that on for, you know, since I took over Black Isle in 96, and now it's 2017. And we have people who still work for us who were in the division that I took over in 96.
Man. So you had a game in development codenamed Van Buren mm-hmm. in the early 2000s. Yes. It was, you mentioned Baldur's Gate 3.
Yes.
You had, it was the original Fallout 3 before we got the Bethesda version.
Actually, it was actually the second Fallout 3.
The second Fallout 3.
It was the second Fallout 3. So weirdly, the first Fallout 3 was after Torment was still in development. And Fallout 2 was done, and we were now going to do a 3D. Like, now 3D was the cool stuff.
Right.
You know, it's, and so we were going to move from being a 2D engine and be a 3D engine. And so we actually started working with this 3D engine called, this 3D technology called NDL. Oddly, and so, and what happened was we were moving forward, but we were still really learning. And Interplay was, it's kind of where Interplay started to kind of run into financial trouble.
Yeah.
And that's where Icewind Dale came from, is that, I try not to take individual credit for a lot of stuff, but it was just one morning, and I was just really stressed, and I'm trying to figure out a solution to this. And I was like, and you know, every once in a while, these inspirations come to you, and I said, well, what happens? Like, Baldur's Gate is this story, our great RPG story, but we all loved those RPG dungeon crawls. So,
absolutely,
why not do that as like a counterpoint to Baldur's Gate? So the Fallout 3 team became the Icewind Dale team. And but the NDL story is the odd one, because NDL was the 3D engine that eventually, I forgot, merged or got bought by Gamebryo.
Oh,
and
wow.
Gamebryo
to make
Fallout 3.
Yes.
So there's weird things. But yeah, Van Buren was weirdly the second incarnation.
So I'm curious, obviously, there is more to this story, which we'll get to. But so what did you think of Bethesda's Fallout 3 mm-hmm. when that was the Fallout 3 that finally came
out? I really enjoyed it. I am probably one of the least critical people about, like, there's certain game types and games. I think we're talking about racing games and stuff like
yes.
that. And I can be critical of, like, I want to have fun playing a game. I don't necessarily have to have a super simulation. And so I don't even know if that's game criticism or it's just like that's a game I like or don't
like. Just you.
I play games as I did when I was on my Atari 2600. I'm just having fun. And I don't mean that to make so that I'm not making any form of like non-statement about Fallout 3. But with Fallout 3, I really enjoyed it. Like, and I felt it felt Fallout.
Yeah.
Now I absolutely understand some of people's criticisms about some of the Fallouts, and that maybe it didn't have as poignant of a story, or it didn't have as much player choice and things like that. All I know is that I felt like I was in the Fallout world, and particularly with like Megaton and that. Decision making and all that
sure.
kind of stuff. Like, I don't know. I really enjoy it. Mutants felt like mutants. The Vault Boy felt like the Vault Boy. I felt like I was in that world.
Did you nuke Megaton?
I did not. I'm horrible. I am the Paladin. I just I don't know why. When I'm playing Shepard, I have my
Paragon.
I was going to Paragon. Oddly, weirdly enough, at home as I'm playing like Mass Effect 2. Where I live in Irvine, there's all this new construction. And I don't know if it's just one of those weird things that happens. I'm driving into work one day, and the new street that's going to this new housing developed is Paragon, which I'm like, I'd never seen the word ever anywhere else. But yes, so I'm always playing the Paladin, with wants his Paragon to be as high as possible.
So speaking of good evil, you guys partnered with LucasArts mm-hmm. to make Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic 2, which is a sequel to another just massive game.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If my research is correct, that wasn't your first idea for a Star Wars game to do
no.
with them, was it?
No. Our first idea, and I still hold to this, I still want to make this game or a game like it, but is we had worked with Snowblind on a game called Dark Alliance, which was a D&D action RPG, like a Diablo-like
dungeon crawler.
Which ended up awesome. And we, what was great is could we really kind of work with them on it. Like Chris Avalon had done a lot of design and they were not a new developer, but this is maybe a little bit bigger of a game that they'd done. And so we really worked in conjunction. I mean, they did all the work and it was their engine, it was their artwork and everything like that. But, it was fun to be able to collaborate.
Right.
And then we actually did Dark Alliance 2 internally while they went off to do some other games. And my idea, but we'd always had a really good relationship with them. And so the first idea is like there hadn't been a game like that, like an action Star Wars action RPG, and that was the first pitch. Like, what about using the Dark Alliance engine and making a Star Wars action RPG?
Oh, that would have been good.
It would have been super cool. And Simon Jeffrey, who was running LucasArts at the time, I think he didn't it wasn't like a pitch they thought was bad. I think some people there had a hard time getting their head around it. But you know, we were still talking about it as, you know, as the other opportunity came up, which was KOTOR 2.
KOTOR 2, yeah. So for your team, a team of expert role-playing game makers, is that like a dream come true to get to work on a Star Wars RPG?
Yeah, it was weird. I mean, you know, it's funny. I feel like somehow I've fallen into, you know, being, you know, hitting on, I don't want to, the nerd trifecta means three, but I, you know, a lot of it is I got D&D, Star Wars, and Star Trek in my, you know, and I've got to work. and then I actually got to work in a Lord of the Rings game. So there's all this kind of stuff. But no, I mean, Star Wars was awesome. And now, what's funny though, initially, we were like, we weren't as hyped about it, you know, because part of it wasn't going to be our own game idea,
right.
And it was going to be a sequel. And you know, and I actually have to give Ray and Greg a lot of credit. As I called them up and told them, I was like, I don't know exactly. They're like, well, here's the deal. Like it's your opportunity. I know you're pitching another Star Wars game, but this is your opportunity to do Star Wars, and you're just starting a company. And we can tell you that when you are going to a bank or talking to some company and you say, oh, I'm working on a Star Wars game, they all immediately know what you're talking about. They don't know what games, they don't know this, they don't know that, but they know Star Wars. And you'd be amazed whether it opens doors or doesn't open doors. It helps. And I thought that's a really good point. And then, you know, we got to play earlier builds of the game and things like that. And so, not earlier, we started to actually play the game more. It was this odd thing, you know, when KOTOR came out, we were starting up a company. So we weren't
Obsidian.
We hadn't actually played it a lot. And then that opportunity came, and now we're like, oh, and then once we played it, like, no, this would be awesome. We got to make this.
So the timeline on that game is nuts to me as somebody who's covered games. I mean,
right.
You know, the guy that pays 60, well, 50 bucks at the time, mm-hmm. you know, does it, they don't think about
yep.
it, but you signed the deal to do that game in October 03.
August, actually.
August 03. You were given about 15 months.
14, 15 months, yeah.
To finish a role-playing game,
yes.
A 40-hour role-playing mm-hmm. game. You were given an extension into 2005 only to have that extension rescinded? Is that, I don't know if that
so
research is corrected here. It is correct here. And then the story goes that you were forced to ship it for the holiday season in 04. So what's that? Is it just... Is it just devastating to you guys to have that ship or else kind of that sort of
so
guillotine hanging over your heads?
So yes, but at some level, what are you going to do? Right, this is your opportunity. Right, so you can be mad about it. You can complain about it. We can go to beers and be mad and cry and all this other kind of stuff. But that was the deal. Like
yeah.
in the end, that was the that's what we told. You know, and we learned a lot. I mean, we learned. You know, and I always try to give this recommendation to developer, you know, other developers and everything like, you know, and it's one that I don't always still take myself, but like if you're doing work for someone and that they want to change something about the work you're going to do, get it in writing, you know, and that was the, and I'm not blaming, like, a lot of it is I don't want LucasArts to sound like bad people or anything like that.
Right.
Things change.
Sure.
Right? And the fact of the matter is we moved forward on something without a signed agreement. So I can't tell you if at the top of LucasArts that had all really been agreed to or not.
Right.
I believe our producer, who is an amazing guy, he told us what he was told. And things happen, right? And I think that that's, unfortunately, in some ways what happened with KOTOR. And we just sucked it up, you know, and said, okay, that's what we got to do. And it meant cutting a planet. It meant getting an ending of the game in that was not as robust and not as... didn't have as many pathways as we wanted, but we shipped a game that we're still very proud of.
So then Fallout comes full circle after
mm-hmm.
that,
because yes.
ZeniMax and Bethesda come to you guys for a sequel / spinoff to Fallout 3, which was, of course, New Vegas. Many people love that game. It sells huge. because it was Fallout,
mm-hmm.
was that... a bit more of a labor of love for the team than anything, or is it sort of just another job at that point? Just
No, not at all. I want to say that nothing we have done hasn't been something we wanted to do. Now, sometimes
I didn't mean to infer that.
No, but it's a good question because I think you know, there's, I don't call it the seedy underbelly, but there is a seedy underbelly somewhat to publishing, you know, game publishing, game development, in which there's a lot of developers out there that have to make games that they wouldn't choose at all to do.
To keep the doors open.
And it's a really hard decision to make. It's a really hard decision, particularly when the deal you're getting is maybe not even one that covers your cost. And so what you're trying to do is you're trying to make this decision of, do I close my studio? Or do I do this knowing that in 12, 14, 18 months, I'm actually going to be in a worse spot than I am right now, but it is giving me 12, 14, 18 months to solve the problem.
Wow.
Right? And it's crappy, right? And, you know, and, but that's, and we've been offered a lot of that stuff. I think we've made the conscious decision to turn it down. Now, there's some products like, you know, that are not what we may have thought we would make, you know, but... for the most part, we want to do that. Like, you know, we would maybe choose to do this other product, but this is not one we wouldn't do. And we've never signed a deal that we would be worse off when we started. But with Fallout, no, I mean, come on, we made Fallout, and we loved making it. And I stayed at Black Isle longer for the hope of making Fallout 3. And so... Getting to go back was just amazing. I mean, it was a lot of fun, and you know, as we've always said publicly many, many times, you know, we would always love to go back to Fallout.
So, more urban legends with you guys.
Yeah, right.
So your company infamously missed out on a bonus payment.
Yes.
I'm sorry if you've told the story a million times,
it's totally fine.
So the game sold huge. It was very well regarded. Mm-hmm. It lands on an 84
yes.
rating on Metacritic, which mm-hmm. is a site that, of course, aggregates review mm-hmm. scores using a secret formula that it does. You know,
right. yeah.
maybe it weighs IGN more than it weighs mm-hmm. Joe's RPG Game Reviews.com.
Right, yeah.
Who knows? But you end up missing
right.
team. Your company does not get this bonus
correct.
Because there was this Metacritic clause
yes.
in there. Why didn't ZeniMax just pay you anyway when it's that close and it turns, you know, yes, they're following the letter of the contract.
Absolutely.
But isn't it a little short-sighted on their part to burn, in my opinion, burn mm-hmm. a talented outfit
right.
like Obsidian in a situation like that?
It's a tough... I mean,
am I looking at this too emotionally and not...
It's a very tough question to answer from the standpoint of, like, in the black and white world of you know, we all have to look at the contracts that we've signed and we have to hold up to the contracts we're signed. I have to hold up my end as the publisher has to hold up their end. And, they could say, well, you guys did, you know, there's a lot of stuff that goes on, right? And in which maybe what we did is there were more bugs in Fallout New Vegas when it shipped. Maybe that cost them more PR time to deal with. Like, it's not an uncomplex issue.
Right.
Now, black and white, yes. Fallout New Vegas sold a ton of units. We made a little bit of money, but we made money. I mean, that's the other thing to remember. Like, we're a for-profit business, and we profited it on New Vegas. And they continue to give us the DLC work, and that helped us out a lot, you know, as the time. And I think the other thing that's important is, like, we didn't even ask for the bonus in the contract. I think that's a piece of information that we've never really talked about before. But I thought it was an important thing to say. It was something that they put in there, and, you know, some people can look at it as bonuses in contracts are what they are, right? And we generally ignore all of them, particularly when they're attached to something like Metacritic.
Isn't it kind of ridiculous to have money for bonus money be mm-hmm. tied to what idiots like me say on on the internet?
Oh, no. We have other contracts that our long-term royalty stream is actually if we got lower than this Metacritic, then that Metacritic was actually the percentage of the royalties we would originally get, right? Mm. So because every contract, I think that's maybe something else that people don't always know, every contract that gets signed in making games is different. Like, there's all these different formulas and all these different ways to figure it out. But I think that ultimately how we've dealt with it, and I think, like I said, it's important to say that we're not the ones who put that bonus structure in there. We pretty much, to be honest, I never looked at it as something, we weren't depending upon it.
Right.
We didn't look at it like when we didn't get it, we're like, I mean, okay, honestly, personally, we're like, it does feel a little petty to not give us. But that's me personally, and
sure.
I think it's not an unfair statement that hopefully Bethesda doesn't think it's too unfair for me to say that. But on the flip side, it was the contract, and we didn't ask for it, right? So it makes it a harder thing to go back and forth on. Now, what I can say is that and I think other times that where we've been affected by those things, we just say we're not going to make anything in our deal tied to something that isn't representative of the product being successful. What is representative of the product being successful is how much it makes.
Right.
And so let's just talk about that. If the product doesn't make money, well, then we're not going to get a royalty. So let's not play this game of like, because there's 95 rated games, I'm sure, that didn't make much money, if they made any money at all. So let's just do it. And maybe this is in our world where maybe games are supposed to be art to an extent, that we're talking very dollars and cents. But in the end, that's how we get to continue to do what we do. So let's just tie it to that. And that's pretty much since then. No, I would say since then, we've never had anything in our contracts that says something like that.
That's good. I mean, because even to me, as a guy who's reviewing games,
yes,
it seems ridiculous for...
Right.
That yeah. seems ridiculous mm-hmm. to me, because what I say about your game shouldn't...
Right.
I don't
yes.
think should affect how much yeah. money you get.
Yeah, well, and there's this weird also, this thing, I totally... Because you can also look at the data and say, well, if you look at all the games have sold the most, they're all a Metacritic of 85 or more. But what's the real causal relationship there? Is that, are those because they're big games that were given a lot of money and a lot of marketing and a lot yeah. of PR, or they were really that good, right? And not to put this back on the press, but the press can review games differently based upon the publisher that is doing them. Because there's certain publishers hold the press. I don't think IGN, but there's certain publishers hold the press somewhat accountable to some of the reviews, and because they can say, oh, you don't get a review copy, and you don't this, and you don't that.
That so does
happen. There's a weird gray relationship a little bit. And I'm not saying there's any, I'm not a conspiracy theory or anything like
yeah.
that. But we recognize that. We know that when a publisher, a reviewer goes and just blasts something in our games, like something minor just to create clicks, we're like, go deal with them. Oh, we don't do that. And so did that just cost me a review point? I don't know, and it's a very weird world, and so this is how we deal with it. We just don't anymore. So we hopefully will make games that will all be rated at 85 or more.
Yeah.
But let's just focus on that. If we do our job, that means the game makes money. Then we make money. Let's do it that way.
You could have been making like Fallout Los Angeles right mm-hmm. now if they just paid you for that. It would have been such a nice gesture of goodwill, but
yeah,
I guess it's...
You know what? The best way for me to say it is...
I'm upset for
you. I know, and I appreciate that. But I don't lose sleep over it. I guess this is the other thing that I've done, and this is why I've been maybe around for so long, and I'm not the person that's leaving the industry because we've had things like this happen to us. Right. I just look, there's going to be another game. There's going to be another relationship. There's going to be I've not been involved in making the perfect game. I don't know if there is the perfect game, but we'll do it. We'll make another game, and we'll make a better game, and we'll do cooler stuff in there, and it will even screw up as well. But I don't look at this as everything has to be a battle. Everything's a fight, and everything's a battle.
Probably healthier that way.
Well, it's how I sleep, right? I mean, otherwise, believe me, running a development studio. We all get together from sometimes, the guys who do it, and we're just like, what the hell are we doing? Why are we doing this? We're not all, most of us are not driving Ferraris and Lamborghinis, and we've been doing this for many, many years, and, we're losing our hair now, and so why do we do it? We like making games,
Games.
And so we can't get caught up on yesterday. That's the biggest thing I can say is like, why I can still do this is because yesterday was yesterday. And I'm going to wake up today, and I'm going to wake up tomorrow, and I'm going to try to do better, and I'm not going to stress about it.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm. As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
So I promise we are getting to why you're really here, which is to promote your next game. Your history is fascinating.
Yeah.
Particularly, I mean, it's, you know, you can't be a role-playing game fan and not have played your games and followed your games and respected your games. But every studio has had canceled games.
Absolutely.
That's just the
way more than people, I think.
Right. It's the nature of how the business works. But you guys have had a few particularly notable ones that I wanted to ask you about that have sort of made their way public in some form or another over the years. The two I wanted to ask you about are Aliens Crucible and an Xbox One launch game called Stormlands. Yeah. So tell me about Aliens. How far along was it? What happened to it?
You know, I almost want to, like, at some point get a hold of Sega and said, hey, let us release some footage because I think it would be cool.
You know who to call.
I think it would be cool for people to see it. It was pretty far along. I do not blame Sega for canceling it. I blame, the only thing I would say is I think they were a little short-sighted at the very end because this was a new engine and obviously a license and new gameplay that we were putting together, trying stuff, different stuff than Mass Effect had done, and it was just a lot of stuff going on. And I think that it took a while for us to understand what we needed to do. And, you know, and I've said this before in a lot of interviews and stuff, like the sad thing about it is we delivered an amazing milestone and then got canceled 2 days later, right? And so, you know, obviously we can still boot it up, though I just booted it up a little while ago. You know, we're doing something new, and I was just booting it up to look at what we'd done. And yeah, again, the graphics don't hold up perfectly today, but they still hold up pretty damn well. Yeah. And it was just, it was a party-based Aliens RPG, and you had a ton of control over your companions. You could, you know, select a door lock. Hey, you go unlock that, and you go sit there. Here, put a sentry gun down there, and then the aliens would come in. I guess the one thing I guess we probably learned a lot from doing that was, like, man, aliens are hard. Like, and just, they're just hard. Like, you know, and you don't think about it as, like, even as a game maker, and you think, okay, I have this quadruped thing with a super long tail, and I have all these big long pipes with airlocks. Well, how the hell do I have an alien go like this and have it not look just, like, totally janky, right? And so that was a lesson. But no, that was it. I think I understood, not mad at Sega. I just wish if someone had just like, holy crap, this is now, like, this is a game now, and it had a pipeline now, and we had a level editor now, and we had all these things. And so it's like, if we could just go on one more milestone, you know, I think there would have been an Aliens Crucible on the shelf.
Is that, when something is that far along and you had hit a big milestone and then 2 days later that happens, I mean, is the team just demoralized for a while after that, or how, you know, what's the, it's, I'm always curious to go inside the mind of a game developer. Do you just kind of pick up and move on because you have to, or how is the psychology?
I think it all depends on the situation. Obviously, if as it was with Aliens and Stormlands, the cancellation was attached to a layoff, and that's always super hard. It's, I mean, you take it as a failure. Like, I mean, I just, you know, it makes me feel like I'm the worst person ever, that I'm putting this person out on the street, and so these people who have maybe worked with these other people for months or years, they're now not in the office anymore, and so it kind of breaks up social circles, and so that's the worst kind of cancellation, because you have the people part of it, as well as this thing that I had been putting, almost like postpartum depression, in that you've been putting all this energy into something, and now now it's gone. And I don't want to say that post women's, you know.
I know what you mean.
But yeah. So, but you even get that, you know, you even get that when you ship a game. I remember, I mean, this has happened a lot, but I remember the real first time for me was, you know, when after Fallout shipped and Fallout 2 shipped, we were just busy with other stuff. So I was immediately in the office. But it was really Icewind Dale was this weird, I had a little bit of time after Icewind Dale, and we were just really working hard and crunching to get it done. And I get back to my condo, sitting on and I just had to leave at like 3 p.m. just because I'm like, I got nothing to do, and we just shipped it, and I'm freaking tired.
Yeah.
And so, and I just remember I just sat on the couch looking at a, you know, TV that was turned off, and I'm like, all right, now what do I do with myself? You know, and it's weird. You're trying to get out of it. And I think that's a little bit when teams get canceled. It's like this, I'm doing this, now I'm not doing that. That design document, I don't finish it anymore. I don't, like, it's just done, you know. It's different, though, than when you have a cancellation, you don't have a layoff. So we had a cancellation. We were doing a game for Disney called Dwarves, and that got canceled. But luckily, we signed up Alpha Protocol as that was happening, and we didn't lay anybody off. It was just the team just moved over. And so, I mean, there's still people at Obsidian who are disappointed that Dwarves got canceled. it's like, you're getting on the horse right away.
Right.
So when the horse isn't there right away, that's really hard. And that's really what happened with Stormlands. The horse wasn't there. We tried to...
Yeah. Tell me about that game, too. It worked that into this, please, because I was curious.
Yeah, with Stormlands, it was Xbox launch title, open world, you know, kind of a new RPG world that was very focused on storms and this idea of almost like a post-apocalyptic fantasy, you know, world. And... Josh Sawyer was running the project. He had also done he was the game director on New Vegas. And it was a cool world, and we'd pitch it to a lot of people. We had a cool demo on the 360, and we signed it with Microsoft. And a number of things happened, I don't fault Microsoft. I do think in some ways they handled it a little poorly. And I think if there's anything that I would say, don't, you know, if I could give people advice, don't do this. Don't sign up a epic RPG, and we were working with an executive producer for like 6 months from when we first pitched it, and you know, we were all in sync on everything that we wanted to do. We signed the deal, and 2 weeks later we're given a different executive producer who had completely different ideas about what he wanted to do with the product. And on top of that, he was new at Microsoft, and so he wasn't as instilled in how everything worked there. He didn't have political capital. Like, and it sounds weird to say that this is part of making games, big games. Like, but all it's odd how much this matters.
Well, this is the stuff I'm fascinated by, and that's actually one thing I love about these interviews on the show, is because that I think that's players don't hear about this stuff. Because I'm listening to your story and I'm thinking you're a renowned role playing game developer, and Microsoft has signed you to make a big, awesome RPG for the Xbox One launch, where they know they're going up against the PlayStation 4, and it's how does Microsoft not get fully behind that game? And you know, because you'd think they'd want to have that Obsidian Entertainment ace in the hole,
totally
ready
sense.
For November 22nd, 2013.
Because it's scary. No, it's because it's scary, because so many games fail, and because. And I would say RPGs are even harder sometimes for publishers and Sony and Microsoft and to understand, because you know the brilliance of a RPG is sometimes hard to see, and it's hard to see it for 2.5 years, because like I'm not saying that an RPG is so much different or so much more cerebral or anything like that, but if I can get an FPS level up, I can understand really the gameplay of an FPS fairly quickly, and does this have cool features and does it look really good and everything like that. An RPG is, I mean, how long does it take you to playing an RPG? This is amazing. It's all about like that minute of you know, maybe say something stupid, but it's the minute of starting in the tavern and going and killing rats in the cellars, right? And it's all this buildup and it's all this story and things like that. We can't have that in 6 months. There's just no way. There is no way to show anybody from having nothing to having that in 6 months unless they are they're a publisher or a studio that understands that.
How have you not earned that trust as given your track record? I guess can you share, or do you know why that game was canceled by Microsoft when, again, like you'd think for launch they'd want to have out there? Is it just I know every company, even Microsoft, has budgets, you know, because they were funding Dead Rising 3 at that point. They had Rise going on, plus their first party stuff like Forza 5. Was it just we're not quite sure about this thing yet, so we only have so much money, so let's pick this? But I guess help me understand Microsoft canceled.
Ultimately,
that.
I can't tell you. I think that it comes down to budget, right? It comes down to budget, and it comes down to having a champion, right? Because I can see games that had champions and weren't canceled until $80 million were spent. I can see there's games that had a $10 million budget and had a champion, and ended up the budget was $60 million and it shipped. And so in the end, I think the challenge is there has to be someone, when you're talking about big budget stuff, there has to be someone at the publisher or Sony or Micro, I guess they're publishers too, but is that if that champion isn't there, and there's not the person to just say, look, no, it's going to be good, and yeah, it's not where it is right now, and yes, we're maybe going to spend another $20 million on it, it's going to sound horrible, and you know what, everybody, just suck it. You know, I mean, not, of course, that should ever be said that way, but there has to be someone with that attitude and the ability to defend the game. I'll even go back all the way back to Baldur's Gate, you know, so the position I was in. Baldur's Gate was... we all thought it was awesome, right? And it's doing really well. And the sales forecast came back from Europe. And sales forecasts are attached to how much it's going to be marketed in PR. So the sales forecast from our European office came back zero. They weren't going to sell it. D&D is meaningless now. We don't believe in RPGs. And so it had that actually then impacted how the American Salesforce was thinking about it.
Wow.
And so I think Baldur's Gate would have been successful anyway. But no matter, I think... For a game to truly be big, it often has to be pushed, and it has to have ads and PR and all this other kind of stuff. And I remember I went to Brian. I said, Brian, because he's busy, and Interplay was going public, and there's just all this kind of stuff. And I just grabbed his time, and I said, you have to help me push this game. There's going to be a huge sales meeting in a couple weeks. Well, this is where Interplay would bring in all the sales reps, like Best Buy and all this kind of stuff, and do a weekend. Please get up in front of everybody and say this is going to be amazing. You need to sell. They're not listening to me. And so he did. He went up there and he sold it. And the sales forecasts went up. And it got more PR and it got more marketing dollars. And BG would have been successful anyway. But, it sounds like I'm maybe patting myself on the back. But I'm just using it as an example of when you don't, that's when you don't have that. So ultimately, the answer to your question, why did Stormlands get canceled? Stormlands got canceled because we didn't have an advocate.
So that brand new executive producer didn't have Phil Spencer's ear, who was running studios at the time, to really fight for the game.
That is my best guess. Interesting. Is that and it just yeah.
You it's know. From a player game game player's perspective, mm-hmm. it's astounding to start to hear about how mm-hmm. much of video games is political.
Yes. Yeah, it is.
It's awful. It's not necessarily about how good the game is. Politics sometimes.
No. I know that Human Revolution 2 would have been out 2 years before because we were a developer that was going to do it.
Wow.
And there was a budgetary issue, and they totally want us to do it. But there was a budgetary issue, and some other games didn't sell as well, and they needed to do it internally to be able to give a team a job.
Right.
And so we didn't end up doing it. But other things happened, right? It's funny, I think, when you have developers that have been around a lot, you'd be amazed at the stories of games that didn't get made.
I would love to do a whole show about that.
I find it shocking sometimes, this stuff. And because sometimes it makes so much sense. I mean, we even say this, and I don't want to disparage anybody at Microsoft or anything like this, but we would have gotten Stormlands done. It would have been good, and it would have been out, 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Dumb Microsoft. It's just, oh, that's too bad.
Right.
Like, that's a game that no one's going to get to play now, and that's too bad.
Is it possible that with cancellations like the ones you've suffered, and every developer has suffered in some way along the way, could Stormland, could these things ever come back, or does time just kind of move on eventually and you got to kind of let it go and move on to the new thing?
It depends. Now, Stormlands is interesting in that Stormlands actually came from a previous pitch of a pitch that we called Defiance that was about this post-apocalyptic fantasy world. And we had this concept of where evil won. Stormlands took some of those ideas, not all the ideas, but took some of them. And then when that got canceled, we then kind of went back to the Defiance pitch and made this new pitch, and we actually called it Tyranny. And so we actually then went back out on the road, and we were able to show other publishers sort of all the technology and stuff that we had done for Stormlands. The problem is this is the other thing that happens. So there's already a lot of stress about signing up big products and things like
sure.
that. So here's the other challenge. So I just had a product canceled. It's always public. When you're a larger studio and you've done layoffs, everybody knows it's canceled. It doesn't matter how good your pitch is, and when you now go up and try to sell that product to someone else, they're like, well, Microsoft canceled it. It doesn't, you know what I mean?
It's like human nature, I guess.
It's human nature, but is it wrong? It's not. It just is, right? But what we ended up doing, we tried to go back to that Defiance pitch, much more evil one. But then we started talking to Paradox, and we had now, I forgot how much longer, a couple years later, and we then end up using the Eternity engine. And so instead of it being sort of a big console, the ideas of that morphed into what became the game Tyranny that shipped a couple months ago.
And it's excellent.
Yeah,
good
yeah,
game.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all right, let's move to what I hope is a happier topic, and that is the fact that you got to work with yet another big IP a few years ago in the form of South Park.
Absolutely,
I remember
yes.
when this was announced,
yes.
I was completely caught off guard.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I love your guys' work, and I adore South Park.
Yeah.
I've seen every episode. And I thought as that Matt Stone and Trey Parker were done making video games
because it
had gone horribly for
yeah.
them. Yeah. So the game... The Stick of Truth was absolutely fantastic
on all
counts. It was, I don't think there was, for me, it was probably one of the two or three best games of the year, period.
Awesome.
What was it like to work with those guys, with Matt and Trey?
Oh, it was awesome. I mean, I think that they're great guys. They love what they do. Trey is a huge game player, so that's helpful. Like sometimes when you're doing licenses, the person that you're dealing with is not someone who plays games,
yeah.
And so you're trying to deal with a lot of stuff and trying to explain stuff that they don't understand. And so that was great. I mean, and they gave us a lot of their time. And I think the only criticism I would ever have is that, and it was not their fault. It was just that one, Book of Mormon took a lot of their time, and then when Book of Mormon exploded, it took even more of their time. And that was they wanted it to be successful,
right.
But they just didn't know how successful it was going to be and how much it was going to take their time. But they were they welcomed us into their homes. We flew out to New York, and we would hang. We would do design meetings in Trey's home and in Matt's home, and so apartments. And so they were great, and they tried to give us whatever time they could.
So I have to ask, did it frustrate you to not get to make the sequel?
Yeah, it did. So this is a weird one, right? It really.
You've got to hold a grudge. Before we get to the end of this interview, you're going to admit that you have a grudge against someone. Maybe it's Ubisoft. I don't know who it is, but no. But seriously, you made a great game in the Stick of Truth. Against all odds, it's this fantastic.
Yes, against it's the best way to say it. You know, and I think at the end of what I said, I was talking to some people. I was actually at DICE a couple years ago, and I said, I think at the end, just everybody needed a hug, you know. And it was hard, and there was a lot of stuff going on, and you know, Trey's having a kid at the very end of it, and you know, and it was just a lot of stuff going on, and you had the whole THQ going bankrupt in the middle of it. So here's the best way to say it is. Yeah, was it? Did we feel slighted by not even being offered it? Of course. I mean, that feels like you did a really good job, and then they don't want to date us anymore. I mean, you know, I mean, it's kind of, you know, like that feels bad. But on the flip side, you know, I think that it's odd if they had offered it to us, we couldn't have done it because we just had no capacity. Like we're not gonna, like, I don't want to have 17 teams, right? We already had too many teams at the time, and we couldn't have even done it. And so, but you know, I am disappointed in certain ways that we didn't get to make it. Cause, you know, some of the challenges we had on that game I don't want to blame not third party stuff. I just want to blame other things, but it was really hard to do the game we wanted on the Xbox 360 and the PS4 because of memory. And was like, well, it's a 2D game. What are you talking about? PS3 and the 360. But, it was hard because we wanted the game to so much look like the cartoon. And this sounds dumb, but if you want like Cartman's face to look perfectly round at like this size on screen, it's just a billion polys, right?
And the irony of that.
Yeah, I know. Isn't it weird? it's like to have all these kids with all these different all these different like clothes and looks, and even though it's all based off the kind of the same thing. The thing which people don't know as well is like the animation rig, and when I say animation rig, so it's the skeleton. It's the skeleton that drives the animation. Yeah. We call them animation rigs. The animation rig actually in South Park is more complicated than any game we ever did. Because as the character moves and things, it's not like a 3D model. I can just twist the camera. It's still the same 3D model.
Right.
It has to transition into all this other kind of stuff. And it had to be everything couldn't be hand animated like the show. A lot of challenges. And it was just, a lot of us were so like, God, if we could have done this now on the PS4 and the PS4 and the Xbox One because of the memory. It really just was, a lot of it was just memory. Having that memory to have that graphics that's so crisp. I think that would have been awesome. But again, not trying to blame those consoles and things like that. It would have been cool. It would have been fun, I guess, is the end to say.
I mean, I do have to ask too, I'd love to get Matt and Trey here, but until that time. As outrageously funny as that game is, and so there are scenes in that game where I was just shocked was there other ridiculous things that hit the cutting room floor for one reason or another?
I don't know
if
I should say this one, but I'll say it anyways. So there was a boss fight with Paris Hilton at one point, and her boss attack was the Vag Blast. And that was, however you're picturing it in your head, that's it. So there were things like that. And that was, I think a lot of it is Trey has so many amazing, cool ideas. Oh, that one I think was ours. But I think that the Trey has so many ideas. And I think that, you know, there's, when we say we made a game, we made four games and you got a quarter. And that's not like it was, that's not like, oh, we had 400% of a game and in the last month we cut it. That's not what it is. Just as we were making the game, like we realized a whole tree, like crazy huge treehouse that had a whole LARP quest, and it kind of taught you how to play the game and all that kind of stuff. And it made sense at one point, and then Trey was looking at it, and rightfully so. He said, look, but in the backyard they don't have a tree that's like 19 screens, you know? And so while it felt right at the beginning, and then that turned into what was the backyard eventually, and which was more kind of like, you know, just what, you know, what kids would make, not this weirdly realized giant treehouse.
So why does the Paris Hilton hit the cutting room floor?
You know, I don't even remember. I'm sorry. It was so
Is it
long.
Legal?
It
Is
was
it?
So long ago. I think the level that it made sense for got changed a lot. And I think that we were also What was interesting, and it doesn't matter now, but what was interesting when we first started the game, it's going to sound so weirdly legal, but is that the First Amendment actually didn't cover video games. So basically in libel and slander and you know protection of speech did not actually cover video games very well. It still covered print and TV.
Yeah.
So what they could do actually on the TV show, we couldn't do in games necessarily. And so now that's been changed. I mean, there's a court case and everything like that. So we had to be more careful in the game about things like that than we would now, actually.
So while you've been kind to share some of the behind-the-scenes stories of all these experiences with all these publishers you've worked with, from an outside perspective, mm-hmm. it would seem like you guys have been burned by big publishers multiple times.
Yeah.
Do you feel like, is it just bad luck, or is it the unfortunate nature of the business? What?
Like with anything, it's not any one thing. I think it is a collection of those. I think it's a collection of mistakes we've made. It's a collection of being too... let's say the biggest mistake I think that we've made ever is that we are stomachs are... I don't know, whatever, our mouth is... I forget the saying. Basically, like, we want to do too much. And we say, okay, we'll agree to that budget. And it's not like we're agreeing, we're not lying, we're not doing anything like
right.
that, but we just kind of like, we're hopeful that we can make the game that we want for that budget. That's not why all of them got canceled, but that's why some of our games ran into trouble. I think the other thing that happened is, for us, is just not being as, games, how you make games now is not how you made them in the mid-90s, and so we've had to transition, and so much of that is that. Now, on the publisher side, I think that is... You know, how the world works now and working for publishers is just, again, not what it was 10, 15 years ago. It used to be, you could see, like, a developer would make a game, and there would be some ups and downs, but it would come out, and it would do pretty well. But publishers were also publishing a lot more games. And so now the challenge is when you've finished a new game, a big game, and maybe the publisher does not want to, because it doesn't know, the publisher isn't sure how the game is going to do until the game is done, or so the game is shipped. But we're done. So and if they've not signed us to the sequel, you know, in essence 3 months before, we need to sign up another deal somewhere else. So sometimes why we've moved from project to project is just because we have to. Like
right.
we can't hold a team for 3 months hoping that we'll get another deal. And now we're dealing with that in our contracts a little bit better now. And DLC has helped a lot. But I think that's, you know, so sometimes where maybe we've been burnt, it's been more of just the realities of how the industry works now.
So with that, all that being said, would you ever put the company to work on a licensed IP again? Or is it just too risky these days to get involved with something that you don't own and control?
Oh, no, I would. No, absolutely. I would do. I would do a Star Wars game. I would do another South Park game. I would do. We would do a Fallout. We would do anything. I mean. I don't want to only be doing licensed products.
Right.
And I would say the licensed stuff that we don't want to do, we would never want to do a movie game. In other words, what I mean by a movie game is like, there are not even that many anymore.
That's
but
true.
Is this idea, obviously, that King Kong comes out and you're just doing a movie right. that follows the exact story of King Kong, and it has to be done for $2 million and be day and date with a movie, right? So we would never do that because it's not about what we do. What we want to do is take someone's world and totally... take their world and go and live within it and get to play in it. It's still absolutely their world, and we respect that. I think that's why people enjoy the licensed games that we do, because we're not there to tell Matt and Trey or George Lucas or now Todd Howard what those things are.
Yeah.
And I know some people would say, why would you say that? You made Fallout. I go, no, Fallout is Todd Howard's now. It's not Tim Kaine's and Leonard Boyarsky's or Fergus Arcart's or Jason Anderson's. It's theirs, and that's fine. I mean, it's a little weird. I mean, it's super weird to go to Target and see the Vault Boy on a T-shirt. I mean, that's just the bizarrest, like what? You know, so, but no, I licensed is good because you just, it's like a break, or it's just, you get to, it's like why people are like, well, why did you do a South Park game? And my answer was, why wouldn't we? Why wouldn't you? You know, I mean, that's my answer. Like, it's not all about have to like have a very specific ways we do our business and all that. Is like, sometimes the cool thing is that we get to do stuff that's fun and just get to play in, like I said, get to play in other people's worlds.
So that brings us to the modern day
yes.
Obsidian, where you guys have sort of increasingly moved away from the traditional publishing models in favor of crowdfunding. You guys have had a lot of success in the crowdfunding field. Do you feel like that the crowdfunding model is the future for the present and or future for Obsidian, Obsidian, or is it just happen to be how you're doing business right now?
It is an aspect of how we do business right now. I think that crowdfunding is incredible and it's awesome, and we are really hopeful for the new crowdfunding platform that we're involved in is Fig. And we're really interested to see, because I think when you look at crowdfunding, there seems to be kind of a cap. Maybe 4 million or 6 million or 7 million, unless you're a board game and then you can do 12. Like, but or you have miniatures. It's all about miniatures. If you can put little gray miniatures, then everyone will give you a lot of money. But I think that there's this cap, and obviously we can do Pillars of Eternity for a smaller budget. But if we wanted to do our own, not Fallout game, but Fallout-like game, that's not a $5 million, $10 million game. That is a $20, $30, $40 million game. And so how can we do that without going necessarily to the traditional publishing model? Now, having said that, increasingly this year, I would say, is publishers have been more open to talking about situations where we could actually own our own IP. We may have to work with them for a little bit longer, but ultimately, so I think I've seen some movement there, even with larger publishers. I think you'd be surprised. But with the crowdfunding, I think it is a great place for this kind of the products that publishers aren't built to support anymore. It's probably the best way to say it. Is like certain publishers are, like Paradox and Techland and Koch and but for, you know, Activision, EA, and Ubisoft, a niche RPG that's going to sell 700,000 units. It's just a weird. It's not even that they don't necessarily know what to do with it. They don't have the people to do anything with it. And I think that's where crowdfunding is amazing. But the hope is, I mean, I would love to see like how could we build it up more? You know, if people wanted to be able to want us to make a game that's like Fallout, as an example, that would be awesome. You know, and so how could I fund it in a sort of a non-traditional manner?
So, Pillars of Eternity, that was big Kickstarter success for you guys. Your goal was 1.1 million, and you ended up about four, like you said. So the game got finished, unlike a lot of Kickstarter games.
It did, yeah.
It released to great reviews on Steam, and about a million-ish copies sold from
right
what
around
I could
there.
Find.
Yeah, yeah, right around there. Yeah.
So was that process hugely gratifying for you guys because it was all you, and there was no publisher involved there?
Yeah, I think that, it kind of comes back to getting to own it. And it sounds like a little bit like I'm all saying, like, I'm going to keep my ball, like, and it's my playground, it's my ball, right? But it really is more of that, we get to decide the future of it. That's what's hard sometimes. We go off and make Stick of Truth, and we have no say now of whether we make the game, we don't make the game, when it gets made.
Yeah.
If it gets made, you know, like all these kind of things. And so with Stick of Truth, I mean, with Pillars of Eternity, it's ours to decide now. And we get to do with other things, like we did a card game, Pillars of Eternity, Lords of the Eastern Reach. And that's fun. Like it's kind of, you know, it's uplifting. It's a lot of us, even the guys who do business all day long, we got into it to be creative in games. And owning your own thing means you get to be just a little bit more creative. Obviously, there's the aspect of it that without a publisher looking over us, like publishers can be absolutely helpful in what we're doing. Sometimes they can get in the way, and they would admit themselves they get in the way sometimes. So you know, but that means that without a publisher, we have to be our own. We have to watch ourselves. I turn into the publisher in some ways because I have to say, hey, no, we have to hit milestones, and we have to get this game done. We can't just keep on making it forever. Luckily, the Pillars team has been great about that, and they really focus on, we do have only so much money, but we need to make an amazing game for the people who amazingly gave us their trust, gave us trust.
And that brings us to now.
Yes.
Talk to me about the new thing.
Yes, so Pillars of Eternity 2. So we've talked about it a little bit here and there, but we're crowdfunding it. And we're crowdfunding it through Fig, and which also means crowd investment. And so it's this interesting thing where people not only, they can do kind of the normal crowdfunding as they would do on Kickstarter with backing the game and, you know, getting the game and, you know, as rewards and other things. But now they have the opportunity to invest it instead and invest in the success of it, and it's going to be interesting to see how that goes. But as a game, I mean, it's super cool. Like, it's you know, we're so thankful to get to work on a sequel. We've not really been able to, and so, which is so interesting to be around for 14 years now and not ever get to work on a sequel. And it's really
already let us, worked on a sequel, but not
well,
the
not
first
for
one.
Our sequel. I'm sorry, a sequel. We worked on a lot of sequels, just not sequels to our own things. And so it's been a lot of fun to now go, hey, we did all this stuff, and some of it turned out great, and some of it turned out not as great. Well, now we get to work on all of that, and we get to work on the engine, and we need to. And so, yeah, Pillars 2, I mean, there's like, I mean, there's a litany of things that are so different about it, and but still at the core, it is that Infinity Engine experience. It is that Baldur's Gate, Torment, Icewind Dale experience that we are again very thankful that people really did want again. And so that's been the focus.
All right. Fergus Urquhart, thank you so much.
Absolutely.
The game
this is
Pillars
great.
Of Eternity 2 on Fig now.
Mm-hmm.
If you're interested in checking that out, maybe getting involved,
yep.
I guess you can invest in
absolutely.
And profit in the
absolutely.
The spoils,
yes,
I guess,
yes,
if
exactly.
the game does well.
You know, and ask questions. I mean, if you're up there and you're like, how does this all work? Just ask a question. We'll be happy to answer them.
But thank you so much again. Your career is fascinating. So many amazing ups and downs and mm-hmm. great stories that you've been kind yeah. enough to share. So for much more from the best, brightest, most interesting minds in the game industry, such as this fine gentleman sitting across from me, be sure to tune back each and every month for a new episode of IGN Unfiltered.
Anna Sheridan, New York Times bestselling author of Supernatural Horror. Missing for nearly 6 months now.
That's not possible. Is the compass broken? Or did I turn to the side?
Given the circumstances of her disappearance, someone with a more vivid imagination might decide she'd pierced the veil, so to speak.
Weak radio signal. 700 meters. Closing fast.
There's no place for ghost stories and close encounters in this investigation, or any other.
I need you to find me.
To save yourself.
Of course.
What else would it be?
The Sheridan Tapes, a serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.